Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Jerome, the podcast that has survived both the holidays and the apocalypse.
Yes, we did both.
Mm-hmm. How's it going, Richard Wally?
It's going great, Cassidy Robinson.
Now, we skipped another week.
We had a hiatus, yes.
We had a hiatus. It was kind of complicated because you, the last time we talked, you were talking about coming back down to Pocatello, Idaho, down from Portland, Oregon, to do Christmas with the family.
Fam, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Home for the holidays. But you weren't sure if you were even going to do that or whatever, and then you
ended up... It was weather pending.
Yeah. Well, it's traditional Richard sneakiness is what it is.
Oh, yeah? Is that what it is?
Yeah. Whenever you do anything, you never let anybody in on your plans. Like, when you left for Buenos Aires for 2 years, you didn't tell anybody you were home until, like, a week later. So I find out from, like, a fourth party that you're back in Pocatello. Oh, no, I find out the day of our Christmas party, us and our friends, that you're going to be there.
Oh, okay.
And then you're like, yeah, you know, we're going to leave in a couple days and blah, blah, blah. So I go see Django and everything on my own, and little did I know, you were actually still in Pocatello for like a week later.
Well, yeah, but it was all weather-related. I couldn't control the weather.
Yes, you can. We've already established this. You control the weather.
I forgot my weather wizard powers.
Yeah, it's only bad weather that you control.
It's only bad weather. It's true. I thought it was only when it was afflicted upon you, though.
Well, if I'm affected by it, then there you go. You're like the cold miser.
I am the cold miser. Yeah.
I mean,
literally the day that we were supposed to leave, there were three blizzards between us and home. And we were like, we probably shouldn't do that. That's a bad idea. There were like huge like crashes and all sorts of horrible stuff happened that day. So.
Oh, I know. I know because I was working during that whole time period. But what I didn't know is that you were still in town. Had I known...
I wasn't in town, though. I was in Downey.
Oh, 40 miles.
Would you come see me?
No. Why would I go to Downey?
What?
Why would I go to Downey?
I don't know. Bender came to see me.
The Hills Have Eyes area.
Yeah, it really is. No, I'm not disagreeing with that. It was time for Jackie to spend some time with her family, and I enjoy her family a lot, too, so I had some fun, too, and we chilled and did some fam time. Mm-hmm. But I saw you a couple of times, and...
Yeah, we saw...
Like a scorned lover or something.
I am. If I went and saw Django by myself. If I had known, I would have invited you along.
But I was in Downey.
Yeah. Probably. Well, so I saw you on Christmas, on the Christmas party that we had, and then the next time I saw you was on New Year's Eve.
Yes.
And in between that time, I was actually calling you to see when we were going to record again, and then you never answered. So, and then I found out that you never even went home.
Well, there's a twofold reason. When I go to the Hills Have Eyes land, when I go there, my phone stops working.
Uh-huh.
I don't get incoming phone calls. I got several messages after I got back to Portland.
Oh, I bet. Because radioactive mutants don't use cell phones, apparently.
No, they don't.
Yeah. But here we are. But yeah, we can go ahead right now and just go into our movie news. We've had 2 weeks for it to build up. But Hollywood tends to sort of close between Christmas and, the first couple weeks of January because everyone goes and does their family thing. So not a lot's been really posted as of late.
Well, there's a lot of, images from films, but...
Yeah.
I mean, I could go into gross detail about those, but...
Gross
detail? Nobody wants... Yeah, gross detail.
Are you talking about the new trailer for The Evil Dead?
Oh, I could do that, too.
I haven't seen the second trailer yet, but everyone's... Everyone's talking it up. I think I'm going to try and avoid trailers till I see it now.
Oh, yeah. I am, too. I did it because it was Red Band, and I was like, hey, why the hell not? And I watched it. I was like, well, they're going there. So, yeah, I probably will. I'm at least going to give it a fair shot. It would be hard not to.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Three big horror movie remakes coming out this year with Texas Chainsaw, which just released this weekend. Then that, and then Carrie also.
Oh, this is true. That's true.
Well,
technically, the other two are remakes. The Texas Chainsaw Massacre is a direct sequel.
Oh, well, I don't know. I'll find out. I'm going to see it either tomorrow or the next day, but... yeah, I've heard nothing but great things about that movie so far.
Is it irony I hear, or is that...
I think that's irony you're hearing.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, so you were telling me before we started recording, you were kind of looking up the year's top grossing movies.
I was.
And we were kind of, you know, sort of surprised by sort of some of the things we see on the list. Why don't you go over that again?
Yeah. Well, the first one I'm not surprised by at all. It's the Avengers.
And that's
number 5 billion. What?
That's number one?
That is number one.
And how much?
1.5 billion.
Okay.
1,511,757,910.
Yeah, and that's worldwide gross over entire
this world. Is worldwide, yeah.
Yeah.
Next, we've got The Dark Knight Rises, and it came in at a billion. Right after that, not too far behind, actually, Skyfall, and it came in at about a billion. As well, a little lower in the millions, 23 million versus Batman's 81 million.
I listened to Mark Kermode's weekly podcast. I mean, it's his radio show, his Radio 5 show that he broadcasts as a podcast. But I listen to that regularly, and he does he goes over the top 10 every week, and I'm surprised at how long Skyfall's been on there. I mean, since it's been released, I think it's still on there in England.
Well, I makes sense.
England, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
Go figure.
They like their Bond.
Yeah.
see, number 4 is the one that really got me. Ice Age Continental Drift.
Yeah, that's what you were telling me about, and that's...
Yeah.
I don't...
175 million worldwide.
It befuddles me.
It surprises the hell out of me. Because then next you have The Hobbit. Now, The Hobbit still has some time to make some money and stuff like that.
Yeah, in the next, little while, it'll definitely
I think
make
it's gonna
some
hit
more money. Yeah.
But the fact that Ice Age is there at all is just like, whoa. Next up after number 5, that was The Hobbit, we have Twilight. Doesn't surprise me. It was also, it's 813. Million.
Yeah.
After that, The Amazing Spider-Man at 752 million.
Uh-huh.
Then next, Madagascar 3 at 742 mil.
I mean, that's almost surprising in the same way that Ice Age. But I would have thought that Madagascar, between the two,
would
be higher because it's part 3, not part what? 6 or 7 or whatever the Ice Age movies are now.
Well, you would think, I would think also Brave or Wreck-It Ralph.
Agreed.
Or should be, at least.
Yeah. We're not talking about quality, though.
I know.
We're just talking about pound
what
it pound.
Well, yeah, talking about that, Hunger Games made $686 million.
And that was one of the years, or 2012's first, like, big hit. I'm surprised that's not higher, actually.
What's funny about that, too, is I'm pretty sure it made, like, 500 mil in the States.
Yeah.
And so that means overseas it really didn't do very well. And that makes me happy.
That doesn't surprise me, though, for some reason.
No, not really. Anyways, at number 10, we've got Men in Black 3 that came in at 624 mil.
Yeah. So, well, something that would be number 10.
Yeah, something had to be number 10. And, you know, it's a fun,
it was
fun little movie.
Yeah,
and it had Will Smith in it.
Yeah, so. Well, yeah, Will Smith movies traditionally always do well.
Yeah, at least decent, right?
Yeah.
So
that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, mostly the Madagascar and the Ice Age are the ones that are like, whoa, to me, yeah. But...
One of these is not like the others.
Yes. One of these. Yeah, no,
definitely. What I was
and
gonna,
the fact that it's not a Disney animated. It's just, you know.
Yeah.
Some other company.
Well, so. I mean, Disney, you know, I don't know. Disney doesn't quite have the same clout that they used to have. They don't, you know, they don't bring in the dollars as much anymore.
I don't know. Toy Story 3 did pretty well.
Well, no, it's true. I mean, the Pixar movies generally do pretty well. But, I mean, that's not... The last couple of years, they have been kind of waning.
Yeah.
We'll see how Monsters University does.
Agreed. Well, I also think, I mean, to be fair to them, too, I think that Wreck-It Ralph was probably the best animated movie this year for me that I saw, anyways. And
I think I probably like Frankenweenie and Paranorman more, if you count.
I did see Frankenweenie, but I didn't see Paranorman, so.
But yeah, I'm actually Frankenweenie was Disney also, but I like, I agree. Well, what I was going to talk about is there's a news item that I found a little bit ago online, and I posted it to our Facebook, like us on Facebook, Jabber Podcast. Not selling it or anything. So there's been talks for, God, seems like forever now, of a new series or a new season of Arrested Development, the popular cult sitcom, having a new season, because its life kind of got cut short. It was sort of canceled after basically 2.5 seasons, and ever since, the audience has sort of found it afterward, but originally it was planned to be a movie, to continue it as a movie, sort of like Firefly did, and now Netflix decided to publish an entire season, which they've already filmed, and now it's just been announced that all 14 episodes of the new season will be available on Netflix at the same time, which is cool, on May 4th of this year.
All I gotta say is there's always money in the banana stand. So.
It's been a long time, though.
Oh, no, it has been a long time.
I think longer than people realize.
Oh, yeah. Agreed. The one thing that I'm just excited to see it again, and there has been a lot of water under the bridge, especially, you know, Jason Bateman's been in a billion movies, it seemed, a billion crappy comedies.
And he has a few coming out this year.
Yeah. Will Arnett seems like he's burned through every TV show and and had a few of his own even.
Yeah.
Michael Cera became like a real person star.
Yeah, he kind of, his career is already, and at one point I think he was the thing that was sort of stalling more Arrested Development is because he was kind of living it, you know, post Superbad. He was kind of like, I kind of have my own thing now. But now that's not really there anymore, so I guess he's more into doing it.
Yeah.
But he's probably our age, if not a little, maybe just a year younger.
I don't know, actually, to be honest.
Yeah.
He seems like, I think he's a couple years. He's got to be a couple years.
Yeah, but I mean, he's like 20, you know, 25, something like that. And in the show, he was, you know, he started as 14-year-old, 15-year-old. So I wonder if they're going to age everybody in real time, or if it's going to take place right after the series left off, or I don't know.
I think it's going to have a time travel plot. What?
It's going to be a Doctor Who tie-in.
Yes, it's going to be a Doctor Who tie-in. Okay, very good.
Yeah. My other news item I was going to bring up is, on the road to the Oscars, there's a lot of these little guild awards that get thrown out there, and most of the major critical groups awards have come out for different cities and certain regional areas, but the National Critics Association, which counts for everything in the States, just awarded Michael Haneke's Amour Best Picture of the Year and Best Director.
Oh.
Which was also which was what won the Palme d'Or. So, I wonder, will we see a foreign film be nominated for Best Picture? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. This year, I think, is going to be a hard one to, tell, actually.
I agree.
I think this is going to be weird. I think there's going to be some surprising ones, or there's going to be a lot of, like, should have been on the list.
Yeah, it's either going to be a lot of snubs, or a lot of people are going to look at the list and be like, I haven't seen most of these movies.
Yeah.
It's one of those years, though, where, you know, the year's out and everything, and there's a few movies I missed, but basically, I feel like I've seen pretty much everything that I need to have seen.
I've missed quite a few. I still haven't seen Argo and a few others.
Yeah.
I still want to see this Holy Motors.
Me too. I want to see it really bad.
It's actually, it'll be at the Living Room Theaters here in a week, so.
Well, go ahead and take a video camera and tape it for me.
Okay. I will, and I'll send it right to your way.
Good deal.
Let's do this so I don't get sued $1 billion. That was a joke. I just want everyone out there to understand on the interwebs.
The FBI is not listening to our podcast.
I don't completely believe that, but go on.
We're on an FBI watch list now for video piracy. Okay, well, I mean, that pretty much covers all the news or the lack thereof, but yeah, I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what brings in 2013.
Yep.
So,
no, I'm pretty excited for it, honestly.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of good potential out there. I'm really excited to see from a few directors. I think we're seeing from Danny Boyle this year, and there's a few other people I was excited for. I can't remember them now, but Danny Boyle's up there. I mentioned that.
It's all right.
Del Toro, of course, but we've already talked about that too much.
I think there's a new Aronofsky movie coming out this year.
Is it coming out this year?
Is it this year? I'm pretty sure it is. The Noah movie?
Oh, that'll be... That's got to be at least interesting.
At least.
It might even be... Actually, to be honest, it could be great, too. So I have no idea.
It could be.
I don't know what to expect from it.
We'll move on now to the pet topic. And I was trying to tie this in sort of with one of the movies that we're discussing today, and I'll be reviewing Les Mis by myself. But I guess what I wanted to talk about is everybody kind of, there's been all this talk in this hubbub about Les Mis, about how it, you know, brought in audiences to tears and how it's so moving and like heartbreaking and everything like that. And I tried to think in my head, like, what movies have actually brought me to tears or even close? And so I wanted to ask you the same question. Is there any movies that you remember within your lifetime, you know, and maybe it's a movie that really affected you at a certain age and doesn't quite so much anymore, but have you ever been brought to tears by a movie?
Man, this is an embarrassing question.
if we were asking my roommate, he would tell us a story about how he cried when Aslan died.
No, I actually, I can think of two right off the bat because they're both embarrassing to me.
Okay.
The first one is Spider-Man. When the very first Spider-Man came out, I totally cried.
The Sam Raimi movie?
Yeah. I was really high. But I just had this overwhelming emotion because they finally made a Spider-Man movie, and it was actually okay. And since I was a kid, I always wanted that, and I didn't ever think it would happen, really. And I know that sounds lame, but I mean, it probably didn't help that I was really high, but...
Probably not.
But in the same token, I still kind of, if there's a pretty good superhero movie, I usually well up, like, once or twice. Not anymore so much, but I used to.
Yeah. Well, at a point in time, you know, we take them for granted now because there's 16 that come out a day.
Yeah.
But, you know, back then, it was something new, and it never really been approached or attempted before, and it was all, you know, for the geeks of the world and the comic book readers, it was all like Christmas every time.
Agreed.
I didn't cry, though.
You didn't cry? Well,
I ate nachos.
And the second one, I don't know why, but it's The Hobbit. Or not The Hobbit, but the first Lord of the Rings. Just every time he goes out in the water, I kind of well up still.
Fellowship?
Yeah, in the Fellowship of the Ring, when Sam goes for Frodo. Yep. Keep laughing at me.
Yeah. That one's, woo! I didn't cry. I mean, I guess it's an emotional moment. Is it just like the male bondingness of it, or...
I think so. I don't really know. I don't really think about it. I try to be manly and repress it. I don't know. I can't really say. It's just things well up right there. And I just sometimes in movies when it gets emotional, like I often, there's a lot of times in movies I'll like well up a little bit. If it's emotional enough. But that one actually kind of brought me to tears a little bit. But
you took like an entire class on Holocaust movies.
Yeah.
And seen like, you know, the worst of the worst of human horror.
That didn't make me cry. That just left me cold and embittered towards humanity. Very differently. No, I mean, some of that stuff was hard, but it was because it was not fake. There wasn't, there was no catharsis with it. It was just all like this almost like strange journey. Anyway.
Yeah.
So.
Well, fair enough. I had to think about this, and I only have a few memories of, I mean, I'm a fairly unemotional person anyway. I'm sort of
Pee-wee's Playhouse.
No, it's sort of like Christian Bale's character from Equilibrium. I just like I sort of don't have emotions. I'm more of just on even keel all the time.
Huh.
So when a movie does move me, it means it has to be pretty good, or it hit me in a certain place at a certain time. Now my first one's kind of embarrassing, so I'll let you laugh at me if you want. But when I was a kid, I watched John Travolta movie Phenomenon on TV.
Okay.
With my parents. And I was young. So, and it's not a good movie, per se. I mean, it's pretty emotionally manipulative. But, you know, I won't lie. I got pretty choked up at it.
Well, that's fine. It's okay. I'm not making fun of you. You're a child.
I was a child. And then later... more recently, I don't know, I think I'm becoming softer in my old age, but I think I might have at least almost cried like 3 or 4 times during Up.
Oh, that doesn't count. Yeah, that gets everyone. And so it's all in the first 15 minutes.
No, I mean, there's a few times in the first 15 minutes, but then it, you know, whenever they call back to that stuff later in the movie, it like it jabbed me in the heart a few more times.
Huh. See, mine was all that first, like, 15 until she's gone, and then I was just like, yeah, I was just overdone at that point.
Yeah. and then it was just over the edge. But, and then another one, like, I think came out the same year, maybe, was Where the Wild Things Are. It's not even so much that it got me to, it, you know, like, emotionally manipulated me into almost crying. It's that the whole movie had this sense of melancholy that, I mean, by the time the movie was over, I needed comfort food.
See, no, I thought it was a fun. I thought it was a good movie, but
no, I loved it. But I don't know it. The way it portrayed childhood and imagination and just sort of the frustration and of what it is to be a child and not be understood. Like I don't know. Like even now, just watching clips from the movie will put me right back in that headspace.
Hmm.
It's very weird, very uncanny.
Okay.
So I don't know, I guess maybe that's, and then, you know, even more recently and kind of in a similar vein, Beasts of the Southern Wild, really kind of got me a few times too. So something about relating back to childhood or making allusions to aging is very bothersome to me. So I don't know. Maybe a moor would, like, you know, send me over the edge.
So not like the Benjamin Button? Nothing there?
Nah, not so much. I mean, I am very impressed by the visuals of that movie and the atmosphere, and it's a well-made movie, but to me, I felt like I already saw that movie when I saw Big Fish and Forrest Gump.
Oh. Okay, so if it's, you know, going old to young, Mork, nothing, but when it's, like, children stuff, it's like, do you just, is it because you really just want to be a kid still?
Probably. I think I have a Peter Pan complex for sure.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Welcome to being an adult in general, I think.
Sucky.
Yeah.
All right, well, we'll go ahead and review our movies. If you want, I can start with Les Mis, and then we can go into Django, or we can do Django first. I'll let you decide.
Just get Les Mis out of the way.
Okay. Here just recently I went and saw Les Miserables, the famous Broadway musical that was turned into a movie, which isn't the first time it's been turned into a movie. It's actually been, I think there was a TV movie in the 60s and 70s, and then there was the one with Liam Neeson and Uma Thurman that came out in like 98, 99, and now this is the first time it's ever been presented with the music that it included from the musical. It's based on the Victor Hugo novel. Basically, it takes place during the, 20-year span of the French Revolution, and Hugh Jackman plays a character named Jean Valjean, who had stole some bread, and then he's being chased down by Russell Crowe, who plays a French policeman, and he eventually kind of escapes and becomes rich, but he's trying to hide his identity, but Russell Crowe still knows it's him and holds this grudge against him forever because of it. Anne Hathaway plays a young prostitute or a girl that's forced into prostitution to try and get money for her starving child, and she ends up dying and letting Hugh Jackman's character take care of the child, and then the movie jumps another 10 years into the future, and then we're in the middle of the trenches of the revolution, and all of these back histories of these characters come clashing together with the war. Now, going back to our crying discussion, I'd heard kind of vastly different opinions of this movie going in, and I tried to avoid as many reviews as possible. You know, I listen to a lot of movie podcasts. I always fast forward through the reviews I don't want to hear yet, and that kind of stuff, and I haven't read any reviews, but I knew that there was kind of opposing opinions on this movie. Some people were really, really moved by this movie, moved to tears. It was just like an emotional train wreck for them the entire time. And some people felt like the movie was trying too hard to bring you onto its side, and felt that it was emotionally manipulative and obnoxious. And I have to say, that's sort of the side I'm on. Now, I think we talked about this earlier in the year, and we were talking about, you know, what the Oscar movies were going to be coming out, and I said that basically my expectations for this was, I'll go see it, I'll think it was good enough, you know, kind of like it even, but basically it won't stay with me.
Mm-hmm.
It actually managed to do more than that. It didn't just impress me on a generic level. It pissed me off beyond repair.
Ooh.
I kind of hated this movie. And I almost am sad that you didn't get to see it, because I'd really love to hear what your whole take would have been with it. For some reason, Tom Hooper decides to shoot the entire movie like a YouTube video. It's all done with, like, really kind of sloppily done handheld camera work, and 90% of it is close-up. And it's edited like a Michael Bay movie, in that, like, it's all done in, like, whips and pans and like, 3-second cuts the whole time. And it's all, you know, framing basically people's nostrils and throats the entire time. So I felt like, even though it's a really long movie, it's like 2 hours, maybe even close to 3 hours long, and the entire time, it feels so claustrophobic because they don't ever open up a scene. You get a few establishing shots every once in a while, and it feels like a breath of fresh air when it happens. You're just like, oh my God, thank God. I actually get an idea of where we are and where the characters are in relation to each other. And then it shoves you back up people's noses for another, 15, 20 minutes. Now, you said you weren't crazy about seeing this movie because the singing.
Mm-hmm.
It takes you out of movies, in general.
It does, in general. I just don't.
Unless it's like a Disney Jungle Book kind of thing.
Well, I mean, yeah. I mean, there's different things that make it okay. You know, if it's a stylistic thing, like there's just a song in the middle for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. Or like in the 90s, they had like some character was in a band and so they played or whatever. It's fine. But in general, musicals, I'm not super crazy about them specifically. Because they sing, and I'm like, okay, you're singing about things. And so if it's supposed to be serious and they're singing about it, I'm like, I can't take you seriously. Just stop.
Yeah.
And so, and in general, I'm just not crazy about musicals.
Well, then you really wouldn't like this movie. There's maybe three lines of naturally spoken dialogue. Everything is sung. Everything. No matter what they're talking about, whether they're talking about the French Revolution, whether they're talking about they're in love with each other, whether they're talking about how they want to enact vengeance on each other, every single thing is sung. Even if it's just like a small little piece of expository dialogue, it is sung. And it's all sung on the exact same level, which is everything is the most important thing happening at that particular moment, no matter if it actually is or not. And because there's no emotional variation throughout the movie. It's all the same tone going throughout, which is 11. Everything, it's like this emotional high wire nerve being exposed for the entire movie. Even if they're just singing like, I stole this bread or whatever.
I need to pee.
Yeah, basically.
Okay.
It is. And There's five or so songs, like really recognizable songs, probably ones you've heard before and didn't realize that they were connected to this play, that are like catchy and they're like musical sounding in that, they have like big choruses and stuff like that and they're sweeping and whatever. The rest of it is all done in this obnoxious sing-talking that everyone does that has no particular melody, no particular drive, and it just sounds like people kind of making up melody as they go. I found this to be one of the most obnoxious, assaultive movies I've seen all year. It was kind of like being tortured for 2.5 hours. If you're not into it by like the first 5 minutes, it's not getting any better.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And the fact that I mean, part of it could be I just don't like this play. I've never seen it. I recognize some of the songs from it, but basically I've never seen the play before.
Yeah.
So it could be that I'm just not into Les Mis. But I have a feeling like if I were to watch it on stage where, it isn't this shaky cam the entire time, and there's actually professional Broadway singers singing this stuff, not lazy actors, specifically Russell Crowe, who I haven't heard somebody sing in a movie this badly since Pierce Brosnan in Mamma Mia. I was not into Les Mis.
Oh, I got that by the torture part.
Yeah.
Sorry. I see, it's funny because you say that, and it's not just my contrariness in general, but I kind of want to see it just to see if it is that torturous. Like, it's like, oh, this really hurt. I got to see if it really hurts. I'll probably wait for like a Blu-ray or something like that. I'm sure maybe Jackie wants to see it. I don't know. And my other thing against the movie right away is the book itself. I thought I never got very far in it because I thought it was very droll and boring. So,
yeah, I mean, I see the potential for drama in that story and I see why people like it or why they think they like it. But the way it was done in this movie with these particular singers, shot the way that it was shot, it was like a recipe for annoyance. It was like somebody littered me with lice for the entire movie. And it's like if one of those things, one of those like five things that were annoying me would have not been there, I could have maybe dealt with the rest. But yeah.
Well, okay. Should we move on to Django then? Yeah. Or Django. Excuse me. Pronouncing it like a white person. Django and Chain?
Django and Chain, the new Quentin Tarantino movie.
Yes.
Speaking of violent torture.
Yes, speaking of violent torture. So, as you said, Tarantino movie, our lead character is played by Mr. Jamie Foxx.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have another lead by Mr. Christoph Waltz. And I don't know why I did that.
I don't either. I think you were trying a German accent, and it just sounded...
No, I don't know why, but I went into almost this, like, Asian accent. And I don't...
Christoph Waltz!
Yeah, I don't, like, insult him even. Yeah. I don't know why.
Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, Christoph Waltz. I'll try not to do that anymore. I can't promise anything, though. The inner Japanese man in me just wants to escape through my mouth.
I think it's just the inner racism because of the movie we're talking about.
Oh, okay. Very good. Yeah, that's right. Basically, Christoph Waltz's character, he sets Mr. Django free and makes a deal with him that if he goes on these and does these bounties with him, he'll take him to and find his wife at this bay plantation where they meet Mr. Leonardo DiCaprio, who is a dandy, and also Mr. Samuel L. Jackson,
mm-hmm.
who is a house black person.
Yeah, he's an Uncle Tom, as they would have called
him. He is an Uncle Tom, yes. There's another way that it is said in the movie.
there's a lot of things that are said in this movie that we can't say in this podcast.
Well,
I mean, I guess we could. I don't know if I would.
Well, did you see, though, the interview with Samuel L. Jackson trying to get the interview to say that the N-word?
He was trying to get the interview word?
Yeah.
That's entertaining. No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, you should find that. It was pretty damn entertaining. He told him if he didn't say it, he was not going to do the rest of the interview.
Oh, my God. That's an interviewer's nightmare, especially if you're, like, some young, dorky, white movie nerd.
And it's Samuel L. Jackson.
And it's Samuel L. Jackson.
I probably would have broke. I'm not going to lie. And then I would have been lynched.
Yeah.
So that was the movie in a nutshell.
It's basically a revenge plot.
Yeah, it's a revenge
spaghetti western. As Tarantino likes to do. Yeah, done sort of in the spaghetti western style.
Yeah.
Which also is something Tarantino likes to do.
Agreed. My basic take on it is I did find it entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
I liked some of the things he was going for and trying to do with it. I do like the idea that he uses the N-word so much that it kind of demystified the word.
Yeah.
And joke well, with and it,
but it, you know, it doesn't use it in the same sense of like a rap song would use it. That word has gone through such an arc of political correctness, where it's at now versus where it started. He takes it back to that era, the South, when it was used as a pejorative insult. And
I don't know if it was necessarily just an insult. It was just...
It just was what it was. It was like describing something as, you know, somebody from Jersey.
Yeah.
Yes.
Somebody from Jersey, that's your level? Okay.
Well, it's something as mundane as that.
Sure. Okay, I see what you're saying. I was like, well, yeah, Jersey Shore is pretty bad, but... I do like that he did, and he tried to tackle some of those, and the empowering, having a strong, you know, black character and stuff like that. Like, uh-huh. I liked a lot of those things. I really liked how he brought in the, like, folklore and made it a German folklore specifically is kind of interesting.
I was really, I was surprised by how Christoph Waltz came out of this movie because that was one of my things worried about it. It was like, well, we've just seen him in in Inglourious Basterds? Are we going to really be able to see him as this? And he's still playing German. How's that going to fit into the whole thing? And I really liked his character a lot. And I thought that, the whole relating it or mirroring it or paralleling it to the German folklore story that he tells in the cave was interesting. I liked that part.
Agreed. No, that was one of my, that was probably one of my more favorite parts. I also did enjoy Leonardo DiCaprio's dandy depiction as well, quite a bit.
I mean, I feel like Tarantino, as of late, especially, is having more and more fun writing villains. And he's writing, you know, I mean, really, you know, arc villains. Before, like, you know, in Reservoir Dogs and up through Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, his villains were never full-on villains. You could always see something from their point of view or kind of see where they're coming from. Now he's writing, you know, black and white, no pun intended, villains, and he really gets to dig into, like, how to make them sort of lovably sadistic.
Agreed. I also really liked the framing and everything of the movie.
Yeah, it looks great.
I thought it was filmed well. I did have quite a few problems, though, as well, which was kind of actually unexpected a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the things didn't seem tonally. It seemed like it was all over the place.
I would agree with that.
Specifically music. A lot of times, really, I was like, what in the heck? And also, I don't think him going back to his... I think he went way too much to, like, a exploitation film kind of sensibility a lot of times. I think that he needed to pick a tone and go with it. And I think he should have picked Western. Just went straight for Western if he was going to do it. If he's going to go to the genre, I don't think that those chunks worked. I didn't understand the horse dancing at the end. I thought that was really silly and unnecessary.
Sorry, the what?
The horse dancing?
I don't know if I know what you're talking about.
Where Jamie Lee Foxx makes his little horse do all the little, like, jigs and stuff at the very end.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
To me, it was pretty similar to... I mean, this might be going far, but this is how I felt, really. It was sort of like when in the Alice in Wonderland adaptation, Tim Burton's, when the Mad Hatter was just all of a sudden broke down and started dancing at the end. I was like, there's no... This adds nothing to the plot, what's happening in the film. I don't think it makes it any more fun, anything.
Yeah.
I just had a hard time kind of swallowing the ups and downs of the film in general. And overall, I'll be honest, I was pretty excited. I just couldn't help but be. Glorious Bastards is my favorite film of his. And so, he had a real high point for me, specifically in his career. With his last film, and I really enjoyed seeing it. And this one, there was a lot of stuff that really kind of, like, almost irked me at times. Overall, it was pretty entertaining, enjoyable. There was definitely redeeming qualities, which from somebody like him there would have to be. But there was enough that kind of bothered me.
I think we're basically on the same... I think you might have come away with it a little bit more negatively than I did. But I do think this is lesser Tarantino. I do think that considering what he's trying to talk about and what he's bringing up and how he approaches it, because we're talking about slavery, we're talking about Southern racism in the, you know, pre-Civil War, we get to see some, you know, the way he shoots some things really, really violent, really, really graphic. He's talking about, you know, forcing black people to fight each other for entertainment. You know, it brings up a lot of really hard stuff. And I think one of my issues with the movie is that he sort of approaches it in a very flippant manner. Because
almost cavalier at times.
Yeah, like, I mean, at times he shows it for what it is, and it's gruesome, and it should be, and it's shocking. But then but when it's all said and done, you kind of get the feeling like he just sort of concocted this whole thing to do the stuff that he wants to do, which is just have a big revenge movie with a big cathartic ending where, you know, where he goes and shoots the man and all this stuff. And I feel like it doesn't, for all of its hard subject matter and all of the stuff that, you know, throwing the N-word around as much as he does, which, again, I don't have a problem with in theory. I think what the problem is the movie isn't really good enough to earn all of that stuff. So it comes off sort of strangely flippant and a little disarming in that sense. I think even a bigger problem, and one of the things that would have made the movie better and earn all of that stuff a lot more, is that Jamie Lee Foxx's character, Django, is the least interesting character of the entire movie. You don't really get all that much of a sense of what he's about. You know that he's mad. You know that he wants revenge. Other than that, he doesn't really have a character. Yeah, he wants his wife. But other than that, he doesn't really have a character. Everything we learn about Django is through the way he behaves in contrast to everybody else in the movie. And everybody else is a much stronger character. You could honestly have this whole movie be Christoph Waltz, and it wouldn't really make that much of a difference.
No, that's the thing, almost. That's something I noticed, too. I thought three characters in specific really just, I mean, upshowed all the other characters and all the other actors. And that was Christoph Waltz. Leonardo DiCaprio and Samuel Jackson. I thought Samuel Jackson's performance was really good.
Yeah, actually, I think his performance is the best in the entire movie. And I think he sort of knows how to pull all of these different tones together in a way that nobody else in the movie seems to be doing.
Well, agreed. And I really like there was just a scene in there that I really enjoyed from him where he went from that, like, trembling, like almost fake, falsetto black man, if you could say it that way. And he pulls it from that to just stand straight up and addresses Django.
Yeah.
And I was like, there was just power in the performance.
Yeah, no, he hits it right on the head. I think that's maybe, for me, the only real nominatable performance of the movie.
I thought Jamie Foxx did well. His character was very well.
Yeah, I think he did what he was supposed to do with it. I think he did what he could do with it. I don't think the movie's that interested in Django, to be honest. And that's sort of, for me, that's a real problem because it's a hero's journey. And it's, you know, unlike a lot of Tarantino movies, this is his most linear. It, you know, it goes from point A to point B. And
well, also it's addressing racism and trying to be empowering for the black male, Tarantino even put it. And it didn't, I don't know. I didn't really get that delivered except for the fact that he shot, you know, white folk.
Yeah, another big issue with that. So what I think he was trying to do with Django, and the reason why he comes off as kind of vague and sort of undescript, is I think he was trying to write sort of a man with no name character, you know, kind of like a traditional spaghetti western type hero. But and maybe this is a Jamie Foxx failing. I don't think he commands that same kind of screen presence. And so the character just comes off as being kind of bland. And, a lot of people have really complained about the movie being too long and that it drags in the middle. Actually, I think once we get on Candyland, the name of DiCaprio's plantation, that's, for me, the movie starts to get a little bit more interesting and pick up more narrative traction because we start to get to know the characters a little bit better.
Great.
But I think had the first half of the movie spent more time getting to know Django and his plight and his pathos, then it would have actually felt shorter.
I see. No, I agree. I understand that he was going, that's what I got from him. He's a man of action, man with no name kind of character. But you told us his name. You made him a person, you know.
Yeah.
I think with all the other flamboyant characters that are in it, because Christoph Waltz's character is very, very flamboyant.
He's very memorable, very larger than life.
Yeah. And so is DiCaprio's. And so when you have him against these actors doing these kind of performances, it's really easy to get lost. And like I said, we don't learn anything about his pathos. We don't learn a lot about him, and I think that was a problem because he was kind of, it felt like to me he was ignored.
And I don't think that Tarantino meant to do that, and I think Tarantino thought that knowing the situation, which is he's a black slave who's trying to get his wife back, that that would be enough for him, and that we could fill in the blanks ourselves or sort of project ourselves or our own pathos into him. But it doesn't really come off that way. He just feels, like you said, sort of ignored. You sort of forget that it's his movie until that last 15 minutes when he gets to kind of take center stage. And then it all kind of, that's when it starts to feel really flippant.
See, for me it was throughout.
I will agree with you again on the tone thing. I think there's an aspect of this movie. There's a lot of spaghetti western in here. There's a lot of exploitation spaghetti western.
And then black exploitation, which kind of makes sense, but the how he mixed him does not feel authentic. It feels like, I don't know, like there are parts to me, and I do mean this, that feel like a hobo with a shotgun or rubber or something like that. There are parts of this movie that I'm like, this does not work.
Well, I would say one of the things that it reminded me of from time to time is it kind of felt a little bit like Blazing Saddles.
There's one
specific scene that I'm talking about with Jonah Hill and Don Johnson, and they're fine in the movie, but there's this one scene where they're playing, it's a very, very jokey, arch kind of comedic bit, and Tarantino's never really done comedic bits before. His comedy usually always comes from sort of a nervous energy, but in this one, there's a lot of like these kind of jokey setup-y kind of scenes or comedy set pieces like this one where they're KKK members and they start talking about how they can't see out of their masks very well. And I just thought I don't know if you can have that scene and play it that satirical and then go back and try and like really be gritty and violent and fucked up at the same time. There's a weird sort of grinding of the gears that happens between those.
See, and I think you can, I just don't think it was done.
Yeah.
just straight up. The other thing too, I don't know why it bothered me, because it hasn't bothered me in a lot of other films. I didn't like his cameo in the movie.
Oh, no. Well, I mean, I saw an interview with him where he said, you know, that was meant to be for somebody else, and it was kind of a last-minute thing.
Yeah.
That he kind of had to do it because he didn't want to, you know, pay a famous person to be in the movie for 5 minutes.
No, and I mean, it was a bit much. It felt a little bit. And so, I've kind of gone on the negative a little bit more. Because there were some very entertaining things about the movie, and mostly it was performances and characters specifically.
Sure. I mean, it's still a Tarantino movie, and you can still watch it, and you know exactly who did the movie. It's my least favorite Tarantino movie, I think. Maybe even it's between that and Death Proof. But I still think it's, you know, of quality, and it's perfectly entertaining, and you know it is his funniest movie. My issue with it is that I don't feel like Tarantino as a director is really growing anymore. I think he's more interested in satisfying his own genre fetishes than really telling an interesting story, like, or telling a subversive story. Like the Tarantino that did Pulp Fiction and Jackie Brown, I don't feel is the same Tarantino who did Kill Bill and Django.
I mean, I think I agree with you, but I also, again, Inglourious Basterds was one of my favorite, and I do think that it kind of went back. I think it played with it, I think it did what it needed to do. And I mean, I have my own theory. We've talked about this, the subtext.
Yeah, you have a subtextual read of the movie that makes it very, very interesting, and I really like your interpretation of the movie. I don't know if it was intentional or not, though.
Agreed. No, I agreed. I don't know either. And in time, it doesn't really matter if it was or not, right? But specifically, I thought that was a very strong film, and I don't think it had as many, even though he melded some of the exploitation and he did a lot of that stuff in it, I believe it worked in that film, whereas this film, it did not.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting because they're very similar, I think. They both want to satisfy very similar things, you know, righting the wrongs and you know, giving you the cathartic justice that history never allowed these people. But I think, you know, it's interesting to watch them neck to neck and see how one is working where the other one doesn't.
Okay. Yeah, no, I agree. But like I said, tonally, I feel like Inglourious Basterds worked, whereas this one, it didn't at all. So I don't understand exactly why, though. Well, I mean, I can pinpoint what I thought was wrong, but anyway, let's...
Yeah.
I think we're just going to be derivative from this point. So...
It's fine. But yeah, I mean, I would still suggest anyone go see it. It's you're still going to have a lot of fun, but it's don't expect the best of Tarantino.
Oh, agreed.
Okay, well, we'll talk last segment with our Netflix homework, and you even forgot that you were the one who assigned this movie to me.
I did, and I did forget about it. Well, I mean, also, it wasn't one I had seen beforehand.
Yeah.
I kind of actually picked it more for... Because, I don't know, maybe you don't do this, but I do this. Sometimes I pick a movie because it's what I want. Sometimes I'm not sure until I assign it.
Yeah.
Or three, sometimes I'm like, eh, I'll try something that maybe he might enjoy, something like that. And that was one of these.
Yeah.
I kind of picked it because I thought maybe you'd want to see it. I know that it had some people had liked it and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it had some interesting actors in it, and so I wanted to try it as well.
You're burying the lead. The name of the movie is Take This Waltz.
Yes.
It's directed by Sarah, written and directed by Sarah Polley. I think this is her second or third film. And it stars Michelle Williams and Seth Rogen. Michelle Williams kind of plays a, you know, late 20-something sort of bored housewife who is unsatisfied by her marriage with Seth Rogen, and she starts a flirtatious relationship with a neighbor who carries a, what are those called? A rickshaw?
Yeah.
He's a rickshaw driver. Seth Rogen plays a professional chef who's trying to publish a book on chicken, and she eats chicken every day. Wink, wink. And basically, she's trying to not overstep her bounds with this new flirtation, but at the same time, trying to reconcile her boredom in her marriage with the possibilities of the other. What did you think of Take This Waltz?
I thought overall the performances were good, but in general, I'm not super fond of movies like this.
Okay.
I don't like the whole, I'm bored with my marriage, so this is the way out kind of movies. And to me, this is what it did. It was that movie, formulaic, but it tried to hide it behind like some art stuff.
Yeah.
That really, I don't think really, I thought were way too long. One, I understood what she was trying to do, but I didn't necessarily care for it because I thought that they were too long. But all in all, it was just one of those kind of films. It was pretty generic and pretty, without the performances and without, kind of the power that they, you know, they kind of manifested.
Yeah.
I don't think it would have been it could have been just a piece of trash. But
yeah.
But because of the performances and because of kind of
it was shot well. I mean, it looks nice.
Yeah, it was shot well and it looks nice. And I mean, she didn't, you know, the music wise and all that kind of stuff, you know, some of the stuff that I was recently complaining about with the Django wasn't there. But
yeah.
There were some, you know, there was pretentious art stuff in here, and it just kind of was blah.
I concur. I agree with you. I really hate this notion of the bored housewife. There's a lot of these movies sort of recent. Eat, Pray, Love comes to mind, where you have these people who are in these perfectly fine marriages with these perfectly nice people, and they're always looking out of the way out. And, you know, to some extent, that's what the movie's about. But I don't know. I had a really hard time defending or getting on board with the plight of Michelle Williams' character because she just came off as really whiny and privileged to me.
Agreed.
And
I thought her relationship, too, the weird thing was it was really pretty decent with...
Yeah, with Seth Rogen.
With Seth Rogen.
And like, you know, he does do a really good performance here. This is not a comedic Seth Rogen performance. He plays it much more straight. And I think, you know, given the fact that this... that the movie hates this character for some unknown reasons, he actually plays it really sympathetically, and I think he's probably the best thing in it. I really thought that the actor, I should probably pull up the IMDb page or something, but the guy who plays the would-be mister, the would-be affair, I felt like his character was really creepy. Like, if you look at, like, you know, he's, like, following her around. He, like, just shows up randomly where she ends up being. They have this really kind of gross conversation in the middle of a restaurant where he's trying to seduce her, like, quite explicitly. And we're all supposed to, like, take him as being tall, dark, and handsome, mysterious. I don't get it. To me, this was, I don't know. To me, the whole thing sort of felt like Twilight for the Sundance set.
Okay. Oh, you know what? Kind of. I disagree. I don't like movies like this. I think a better iteration of it would be something like, I think that Stanley Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut is a very similar film, but does it well.
Yeah.
And it hits those beats and it talks about what these kind of movies want to talk about.
Yeah.
But it does so it in it an adult so fashion.
Yeah, it does so more with metaphor.
Well, it does so with metaphor, but, like, I mean, he also has, like, the fairy tale atmosphere and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he addresses the question, you know, as an adult, you know, as an adult married person,
yeah,
you can't turn off the attraction switch. It doesn't just go off. There is no off switch for it. And a lot of these films are very immature how they deal with it. It's like, oh, you go off with the lover, of course.
Yeah.
No. Like, what? Why the hell? No, you can control your bits and pieces and your wobbly bits. And you don't. And so, I don't know. To me, this is a very, like, this is like a teenage
fantasy
of, of marriage. And to me, it's like, no, you be an adult.
Well, you know, and
I like Nicole Kidman at the end of Eyes Wide Shut, you know?
Yeah.
Sometimes we're just going to have to fuck. no, it's... I think that was... It actually, watching this film or films like this makes Eyes Wide Shut a more interesting movie.
Well, it's a much more complex interpretation of marriage and sexuality. I will give you that. But, I mean, I don't want to just say blanketly that all movies that represent unhappy marriages or, you know, sexual frustration within a marriage, even a young marriage, are blanketly bad. I liked Revolutionary Road for what it was. I liked The Good Girl with Jennifer Aniston for what it was, and it covers a lot of similar ground. I think specifically Sarah Pauly doesn't, I don't know, maybe it's part
of... I'm saying specifically bad films of this origin.
Yeah. I agree with you.
I've said this a lot, but I think any film, any idea can be done well.
Yeah.
But it's just up to the person or, you know, whatever, however that creative mojo works with people to get that right. And I just don't think some people really probably don't have it together in their real life. So how can they talk about it in a fantasy world or deal with those kind of subjects? And see, this one was also kind of weird because they kind of had all those wink and nods to, like, she made a dumb choice. But, like, at the same time,
Well, there's a tack
very
on...
Very strange to me.
There's a tack on fourth act that's supposed to sort of show the other side of the story and earn all of its pretentious whininess. But I don't think it really... It doesn't do it enough, and it's too little too late by that point.
Agreed.
Yeah. So, Take This Waltz. Interesting performances, not a very good movie.
High five. Slap.
My Netflix homework for you next week is a little movie I saw as a preview in front of The Master earlier this year, and I kind of bookmarked it in my head as thinking it could be really interesting. I don't know what it's about. It's a very vague trailer, but the movie is called...
Loneliest Planet.
The Loneliest Planet. And I don't know. I have no... Like I said, I don't know what this is going to be at all, but the trailer was definitely sold me.
Okay.
So
I have no clue, so I'm pretty excited.
Yeah.
I like these kind of blind picks.
Yeah.
Like, even if they end up bad, I kind of like it. Like,
yeah.
It's kind of exciting.
It is. And it's interesting to talk about a movie that, you know, neither of us have expectations for what the other one's going to say or do.
Agreed.
So that's our episode. This is episode 21, I believe. Uh-huh. And if you want to weigh in on anything we talked about, your opinions on Les Mis, Django, but Take This Waltz or anything, you know, suggestions.
Adultery.
What's your opinion on adultery? Have you done it? How did that go for you? You can do so.
I don't want to know.
You can do so at our email address, which is jabberinthedrone@gmail.com. Or you can message us or find us on Facebook, which is facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Like us, and you will see all of our news items and things that we post in between episodes, as well as updates whenever, you know, one of us gets sick or stuck in a snowstorm. You can find us on iTunes. Somebody just asked us about that here recently. Yes, we are on iTunes. Go to the iTunes store, type in Jabber and the Drone. You'll see us. You can subscribe there if that's how you like to do things. If you don't use iTunes or you like to just listen to us on your computer or something like that, you can stream us at Podbean at jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. All of our episodes should be there. I should reiterate that... until I can figure out how to upgrade our service with Podbean, I have to delete episodes every new episode I post. So episodes 1 through 4 are not going to be there, but if you desperately want them, email us and I can send the file to you directly. And as soon as I learn how to upgrade our system or figure out what's going on with Podbean, I'll put those episodes back. But until then, just get in contact with us. You can read my movie reviews that I do weekly for the Idaho State Journal and for the Bannock Alternative in Pocatello on my new movie blog, which is called SaladForkReviews.blogspot.com. I just put my Les Mis review up today. I'll have a Beast of the Southern Wild probably tomorrow. Sometimes I write for the MacGuffinPodcast.com. I'm actually working on an article for them right now. I have nothing to do with their audio or video casts, but you can read some of my content there. Richard's available through our Facebook if you want to get in contact with him, or until we can convince him to get a Twitter.
Yeah, okay.
I want to know what you think every minute, Richard.
Why?
The world wants to know.
Like who?
Well, you know, you're trying to make it in the comic book world and stuff like that. I think Twitter is, that's the new party.
I don't know. I don't want to.
I say this as somebody who never uses Twitter.
I know, and I'm sorry. I think it's the most boring idea ever. Mm-hmm. And the most...
You're not cool.
A lot of times, I don't have to... I know. The other thing is, I also think it's like one of the most, like hear about my life kind of thing, blah, blah, blah. If I was like Edgar Wright, I liked reading his tweets. He was funny and interesting, and yeah.
Yeah.
But I'm not that yet. So.
No, you're not.
Or so don't. If you don't have things to do in your life, don't tweet.
If you don't have things, you know what? That's a good rule to live by. Anyway, that's our episode. And like I said before, this week we will have both an episode. This episode that you're listening to now, and you should be able to find our top and bottom 5, which will be in a separate episode. So until then, we'll talk to you later.
Ciao.
Bye.